This material argues that the dual crisis of ecological breakdown and human deprivation are driven by global capitalism and unequal exchange, proposing democratic eco-socialism and southern delinking as the solution.
A robust diagnosis of structural exploitation requires an equally rigorous framework for the political transition to eco-socialism.
Yeah, let's unpack that right away. Because diving into this piece, I mean, the author does just a phenomenal job with the diagnosis itself.
Oh, absolutely. The research is there.
Right. They bring in this incredibly compelling empirical data to prove that, you know, decent living standards across the globe actually require only a fraction of our current energy use.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they point out that 8.5 billion people could live well on just, I think it was 27.8 gigatons of materials
mm-hmm.
and 125 exajoules of energy.
Yeah, the mathematical breakdown of our current productive capacity is deeply, thoroughly researched.
It is. They successfully demonstrate that the barrier isn't scarcity, but what they call the capitalist law of value.
Right. And the author clearly illustrates that capital inherently invests in, you know, what generates the highest profit margin. So fast fashion or luxury real estate.
Instead of what we actually need.
Exactly. Rather than what meets fundamental human needs, like sustainable public transit or regenerative agriculture. But, and this brings us to the most significant weakness in this first section.
Okay, lay it on me.
The material just leaps directly from diagnosing this law of value to concluding that society suddenly needs mass-based socialist parties and complete democratic control over production.
Yeah.
It completely glosses over the actual mechanics of shifting power away from capital.
It really does. I mean, it feels like expertly diagnosing a sinking ship, you know? Like pointing out exactly where the water is rushing in and then vividly describing a beautiful, safe island in the distance.
But forgetting the lifeboat.
Exactly. Totally forgetting to provide the blueprints for the lifeboat. Like, how exactly do we cross that water? Because a protest movement pointing at the rising tide doesn't just instantly transform into a democratic command economy.
Precisely. There's a massive gap regarding how these proposed social movements are supposed to overcome entrenched financial and military hegemony in practice.
Right.
I mean, capital is not going to voluntarily relinquish control over highly profitable sectors just because, you know, a mass movement forms.
Definitely not. So what's the fix here?
So my suggestion to the author is to chart a phased strategic pathway.
Okay.
Instead of relying on this abstract political awakening or some crisis-induced sudden transformation, the piece needs to outline concrete, intermediate structural mechanisms, things that actively challenge capital control on a granular level.
I want to push back slightly on behalf of the author here, or at least, you know, play devil's advocate for a second.
Sure, go for it.
If the ultimate goal is a global transition to eco-socialism, won't getting bogged down in intermediate municipal policies sort of dilute the macro-level argument they're trying to make?
Well, not if those intermediate policies are framed as structural wedges.
Structural wedges?
Yeah. Let me give you a concrete example of how to implement this suggestion. The author could integrate models of transition, like detailing how decentralized public utility cooperatives operate at the municipal level.
Okay.
You don't just say, we need public energy. You explain the mechanism. A municipal cooperative operates without a profit motive, and because it doesn't have to bleed capital out to shareholders in the form of dividends,
it keeps all that money.
Right. It can reinvest its entire surplus into clean grid infrastructure and lower prices. Over time, it slowly outcompetes and starves private energy monopolies of their regional power.
Building the lifeboat plank by plank.
Exactly. It builds the lifeboat plank by plank.
So you are proving the feasibility of the destination by showing the mechanics of the journey. Like, if you prove that a public utility can outcompete a private monopoly in a single city, you give the reader a tangible blueprint for how that scales nationally.
Exactly. Another concrete example the author could use is outlining specific legislative milestones, like implementing a binding public job guarantee.
Wait, a job guarantee?
Yeah. This is often misunderstood simply as a welfare policy. But in the context of this eco-socialist transition, it operates as a profound structural mechanism.
How so? Because on the surface, a job guarantee just sounds like the government acting as the employer of last resort. How does that dismantle the capitalist law of value?
It fundamentally alters the labor market.
Okay, I'm tracking.
Think about it. If the public sector offers a baseline standard of living, guaranteed living wages, and democratic workplace conditions to anyone who wants it, that effectively sets a floor that private capital is forced to compete with.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
If a fossil fuel company or a heavily polluting manufacturing firm relies on the threat of unemployment to maintain cheap, exploitable labor,
a public job guarantee drains that labor pool.
It absolutely drains it. It gives the working class the material security required to actually participate in a democratic transition rather than being held hostage by the threat of destitution.
That makes complete sense. It shifts the balance of power entirely. And if the author wants to target the financial side, they could provide examples of progressively nationalizing targeted banking sectors, right? To choke off capital pipelines to fossil fuels.
Yes, exactly. Demonstrating these intermediate levers grounds that sweeping vision in achievable political strategy.
Which naturally transitions into the broader global dynamics the piece tackles, because the author spends a significant amount of time detailing how this transition is blocked not just internally, but globally.
Right, through the historical and ongoing extraction of resources from the periphery by the core.
Yes, and the text does a masterful job establishing the historical mechanisms of unequal exchange. I mean, it walks us from 19th century colonialism to the coups of the mid-20th century, straight through to the structural adjustment programs imposed by the IMF and World Bank.
It's a very thorough historical accounting.
It quantifies this vividly, too, citing that billions of tons of raw materials and hundreds of millions of person years of embodied labor flow from the global south to the north every single year.
Examining the active complicity of national elites within the global south provides a more complete, resilient picture of unequal exchange.
Yeah, I noticed that gap as well. The author focuses so heavily on northern imperialist interventions, which are undeniably destructive, of course, but it takes two to establish an unequal exchange of this magnitude.
It really does.
Blaming only the core feels like blaming a bank robber while entirely ignoring the security guard inside the bank who intentionally left the vault unlocked for a cut of the loot.
That is such a great analogy. And that is the core weakness of this section. The material primarily frames global South nations as unified, monolithic victims of structural adjustment, sanctions, and foreign coups.
Right, like they're just completely helpless.
Yeah, and while the author briefly acknowledges the existence of a comprador elite, the piece deeply undercooks the critical, active role the domestic bourgeoisies play.
Mm-hmm.
They are actively facilitating, legislating, and profiting from the extraction of their own nation's resources and cheap labor. The text treats the periphery as a unified block resisting the core, which just completely ignores the internal class warfare happening within those peripheral nations.
And that internal dynamic is fatal to the author's proposed solution. I mean, the solution presented for the global south is delinking, essentially pulling away from Western financial systems to prioritize domestic human needs.
Right.
But if the internal elites of those southern nations are actively benefiting from the linked status quo, delinking isn't just a matter of telling the IMF to go away. It requires fighting the local billionaires, too.
Precisely. So my actionable suggestion here is for the author to integrate a deeper internal class analysis of the global south.
Okay.
Demonstrate how imperial arrangements are sustained from the inside out. Address the internal vulnerabilities inherent in this delinking strategy.
Let's talk about what that looks like on the page. What are some concrete examples the author could use to flush out this internal class analysis? Because it's one thing to say elites are complicit, but it's another to actually show the mechanics of that complicity.
A fantastic historical example to integrate would be the implementation of IMF structural adjustment programs in the 1980s.
Okay, how so?
Well, the common narrative, which the author relies on, is that the IMF arrived and forced these devastating austerity measures onto helpless peripheral nations.
Which is the standard telling, yeah.
But a deeper class analysis reveals that specific factions of the domestic ruling class in those nations actually lobbied for and welcomed structural adjustment.
Wait, really? Why would they want that? If you are a business owner in the global south, wouldn't austerity and the destruction of national developmentalist policies hurt your own economy?
It hurts the national economy, sure, but it massively boosts private profit margins for the elite.
Ah, I see.
Structural adjustment forced the deregulation of local labor laws and the crushing of labor unions. domestic manufacturing monopolists partnered with foreign capital to slash wages in their own factories.
Wow.
They willingly traded national economic sovereignty for localized private extraction.
So detailing a case study of this would prove that neocolonialism requires domestic partners.
That adds an incredible layer of nuance. And, you know, another concrete example they could use to show this internal friction is the mechanics of capital flight.
Yes, absolutely. Because the author suggests the southern nations use capital controls to keep wealth inside their borders to fund public infrastructure. But the moment a progressive government attempts to enact capital controls, the first attackers usually aren't northern diplomats. They are domestic elites rapidly offshoring their wealth.
Exactly.
Right.
Into northern tax havens through transfer pricing and shell companies. Exactly.
Right.
Analyzing the mechanics of capital flight by southern billionaires into places like the Cayman Islands or Switzerland definitively proves that delinking must address internal wealth redistribution, not just national borders.
Because otherwise, the exploitation just changes faces.
Exactly. If a southern nation delinks from the global north, but maintains a brutally exploitative domestic bourgeoisie, the working class of that nation still suffers. They are simply being exploited by local billionaires instead of foreign ones.
Yeah.
Demonstrating that anti-imperialism without domestic class struggle is an incomplete project will make the author's overarching thesis practically bulletproof.
This naturally brings us to the final major pillar of the material. Let's say a country in the global south successfully navigates this internal class struggle and manages to pull away from Western exploitation.
Right.
They are inevitably going to seek new trading partners. And the author dedicates a significant section to China's economic ascent and its growing footprint in Africa. Let's look closely at that.
Yeah.
The material defends China against charges of colonialism by noting the absence of outright genocide or military occupation. But isn't that comparing 21st century geopolitics to 19th century atrocities? It feels like an incredibly low bar to clear to avoid the label of imperialism.
Refining the comparative metrics used to analyze China's economic footprint strengthens the material against skepticism regarding modern forms of hegemony.
Okay, because when reading the defense of China's activities, something just felt slightly off balance to me. The text takes a definitive stance, highlighting data suggesting that China arguably represents a net transfer of value to the continent.
Right, improving the physical exchange ratio and squeezing northern profit margins.
Exactly. But it feels, I don't know, a bit overly generous.
The weakness lies in the analytical framework the author uses to defend China. The material essentially defends China's activities in Africa by pointing out the absence of colonial mass violence, military occupation, and outright genocide.
Yeah.
It concludes that because China isn't behaving like 19th century Britain or 20th century America, the relationship is merely semi-peripheral capitalist exploitation rather than a core periphery drain.
Which goes back to what I was saying, it feels like an incredibly low bar. If we are judging a 21st century superpower by the standards of 19th century atrocities, we are using outdated diagnostic criteria. I mean, building a port is obviously better than dropping bombs, but capture through contracts is still capture.
Exactly. This narrow historical definition of imperialism leaves the entire argument highly vulnerable to critics.
Right.
Readers who understand modern macroeconomics will look at China's monopolization of African mineral rights, technology lock-ins, and resource-backed debt infrastructure, and they will immediately see a sophisticated, modernized iteration of unequal exchange.
They'll see right through it.
Yeah. If the author gives China a free pass based on outdated metrics, readers might dismiss the entire eco-socialist thesis as analytically biased.
So how do we fix that? What is the actionable suggestion to shore up this vulnerability?
The suggestion is to explicitly broaden the definition of imperial extraction to account for modern financial, digital, and infrastructural capture.
Okay.
The author needs to evaluate China's actions against this contemporary standard rather than strictly against the historical crimes of European colonialism.
Give me a concrete example of how to evaluate that contemporary standard. If we look at something like the Belt and Road Initiative, the author rightly identifies that it provides essential infrastructure for South-South trade, which is a crucial step for the delinking process we discussed earlier. How should the author complicate that narrative?
A great concrete example to integrate would be addressing the specifics of resource-backed infrastructure loans, particularly in countries like the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
The DRC, okay.
The mechanism of these agreements often involves a Chinese state-backed enterprise building roads, hospitals, or ports up front. But in exchange, they receive a decades-long monopoly on strategic extraction, like cobalt or copper.
So the author needs to analyze the underlying causality and the long-term math of that wealth transfer.
Yes.
Does the upfront infrastructure outweigh the long-term loss of resource sovereignty? If an African nation cannot service its debt and the creditor gains immense leverage over national assets, aren't they just locked into exporting raw materials to fuel China's technological frontier?
Exactly.
That sounds exactly like the peripheralization the author warns against when critiquing the West.
It is structurally very similar, which is why another excellent concrete example to use would be evaluating the rate of technology transfer.
Technology transfer?
Yeah. A defining feature of historical unequal exchange is that the core monopolizes advanced high-profit intellectual property while forcing the periphery to specialize in low-profit, highly competitive raw material extraction.
Meaning the core gets to build the microchips and the electric vehicles.
Right.
Keeping all the high-wage jobs and profit margins while the periphery is relegated to just digging the lithium and cobalt out of the ground.
Precisely. If Chinese firms operating in Africa are strictly extracting raw materials and are not actively transferring technological capacity, manufacturing infrastructure, and intellectual property to domestic African industries,
then they are just recreating the same dynamic.
They are structurally replicating the core periphery divide. This is true regardless of whether they abstain from military violence.
It's about adding rigorous nuance to the analysis. The author doesn't need to brand China as an evil empire, but they absolutely must hold China to the same modern structural standards they apply to the global north.
Yes.
A practical way to implement this would be comparing a Chinese mining operation in Africa directly alongside a Western one in the exact same province.
A direct side-by-side comparison would be incredibly powerful.
Right.
If the author compares wages, ecological degradation, safety standards, and the rate of profit repatriation between a Chinese firm and a Western firm, they can definitively prove or carefully complicate their assertion that China represents a net positive transfer of value.
Yeah, because if China truly is enabling a delinking process for the self, the author needs to prove it through the mechanics of those modern contracts.
Not just by pointing out that they aren't engaging in gunboat diplomacy.
Exactly. Acknowledging that imperialism has evolved computationally, financially, and legally makes the overall theory of the world system far more robust.
Approaching diagnosis of ecological breakdown is too important to be undermined by a fragile geopolitical defense.
Absolutely. This has been a deeply enriching exploration of a highly complex and vital piece of work. We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today.
We really have.
To quickly recap, we started by looking at the absolute necessity of charting concrete structural steps for the eco-socialist transition mechanism. Instead of relying on an abstract leap, the author should detail intermediate levers like municipal utility cooperatives and public job guarantees.
We then discussed the importance of deepening the internal class analysis of the Global South. By acknowledging the active complicity of domestic elites in perpetuating unequal exchange through mechanisms like capital flight and structural adjustment lobbying, the author can address the internal vulnerabilities of the delinking strategy.
Finally, we looked at the necessity of modernizing the framework used to evaluate emerging global powers like China. By broadening the definition of imperialism beyond 19th century military metrics to include modern financial and infrastructural capture, the peace will become dramatically more resilient against skepticism.
Returning to where we began, the ship is undoubtedly taking on water, and the diagnosis of that rising tide is expertly written. But by detailing specific transitional blueprints, accounting for the internal crew members who might be hiding the life vests, and ensuring our navigation charts account for modern obstacles, the author can present a framework that actually survives the storm.
We warmly invite you to implement these actionable suggestions, reinforce the hull of your arguments, and submit your revised work back in for another critique. We can't wait to see how this incredibly important piece evolves.